Welcome to the Academy. This is my fifth lecture in this series, A Christian Response to Islam. What does historic Christianity offer the world that Islam cannot? And I've chosen that specifically because I believe the best way of reasoning about Christianity is that it explains the most meaningful realities of life. My approach to apologetics could be characterized as best explanation or inference to the best explanation, sometimes identified as a cumulative case. But I think that there are things that Christianity can explain that other religions, such as its major competitor, Islam, cannot. So tonight is the fifth and final lecture in our series. The other lectures are available on the church website. You can listen to them whenever you'd like. Tonight is going to be a bit of a different type of lecture. I'm going to look at the question of ideology, and I'm going to ask kind of a different question. How do we win the war of ideas? So let me introduce the topic to you. Not only does historic Christianity compete in the marketplace of religious ideas with religions like Islam, and not just Islam, Christianity competes in the marketplace with all of the major religions of the world, but I would advocate that there are also quasi-religious ideologies that are also vying for acceptance as a type of world and life view. Now, what I mean by that is some scholars view radical Islamic groups like Al-Qaeda to be political ideologies that have attached themselves to a religious system, in this case, the religion of Islam. Now, that's a provocative view, and it is a view I'm going to explore tonight. Now, there are others who disagree with that assessment. There are others who insist that radical Islam is the inevitable result of an inherently violent religion. And so I want to explore the idea of ideology within an Islamic context. In 2010, a 60 Minutes broadcast aired what I think was a very illuminating view of the war on terror. The date is April 25th, 2010. You can go back and watch any of those shows. Just go on the CBS webpage, and you can take a look at this episode. It was entitled Jihadists and the Narrative. Jihadists and the Narrative. The episode highlights a Pakistani-British citizen, Majid Nawaz is his name. He's a former Muslim extremist who now works to combat jihadist ideology. And his story is really rather amazing. He was a chief recruiter for the Islamic extremist group, Hizb-ut-Tahrir, translated Party of Liberation. Nawaz eventually concluded that radical jihadist Islam is closer to a form of fascist totalitarianism than to traditional Islam. Now, the story, and it is an interesting one, and I'll follow it here a little bit, but I want to give you the juicy part. This guy's going all around Europe, and he's creating cells to infiltrate and get people recruited into this radical form of Islam. Right before 9/11, he gets arrested, and he's waterboarded. And he's put in prison. And lo and behold, he finds himself in prison with the men who assassinated the president of Egypt, Sadat. And he thinks, I've made it. I've arrived. I am now among the elite. These are my heroes. They took out President Sadat. To his shock, the men who killed Sadat have undergone a transformation. They now say that they were involved in an ideology and that the religion of Islam does not advocate the murdering of public individuals. And he just flipped. He couldn't believe it. How is it possible that these guys have changed? But they convinced him. And now, and let me bring us back to the 60 Minutes. In the interview, the journalist Leslie Stahl says, Nawaz says that everyday Muslims with little interest in politics are nevertheless being turned into radical jihadists by what is known as the narrative. And according to the narrative, which of course is a radical Islamic-based ideological perspective or a story, this is their ideology, that's the narrative. A narrative, of course, is a story or a point of view. Their view is that the United States of America and its allies are out to obliterate Islam. That's the message of the narrative. Thus, according to the narrative, both the Iraqi and the Afghanistan wars were waged intentionally by America in order to achieve this goal, to kill Muslims. Now, what's interesting here is that many Muslims who embrace this narrative, and again, it's a political ideology, they also believe that September 11 attacks that killed more than 300 Americans was an inside job performed by the U.S. government. Essentially, George Bush did all of this. Now, that the narrative then involves a conspiracy theory whereby the U.S. government blames the 9/11 attacks on al-Qaeda as a pretense. The pretense is blame it on al-Qaeda and then we can invade Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, while the conspiracy theory that America caused 9/11 in order to create a pretense to then attack Islamic countries is, in my opinion, wildly far-fetched, apparently on the so-called Arab Street, 95% of Muslims accept it as true. Now, this is, of course, something I've said earlier. If you're going to talk with a Muslim, you need to be prepared that they look at politics probably very different than you do. And there is great criticism of both America and of Israel. So this conspiracy theory, which, again, I think is really wild, is nonetheless deeply accepted. So the appropriate response to this proposed American-driven war against Islam, according to the narrative, is for faithful Muslims to strike back against the U.S. on all fronts. And they go about telling this story that America is out to destroy Islam and America's allies are participating in it and al-Qaeda didn't really perform 9/11, it was the American government that did it. So Nawaz asserts that many young Muslims swayed by jihadist ideology are interestingly economically affluent and university educated, rather than poor and ill-prepared to sort out ideas. Nawaz says that in fact it's intelligent people that adopt ideology. And all you need to do is go to London and you will see the large number of Muslims studying in the United Kingdom. And if you watch some of Nawaz's debates where he takes on radical Muslims, you see that lots of young people are very interested in this idea of adopting an ideology. The 60 Minutes episode also noted that the United Kingdom, here it is, universities count an inordinate number of radical Muslims among their students. According to Nawaz, the narrative is a clever use of propaganda by a totalitarian ideology he calls Islamism. That's his view. You can go on his website. It's the Quilliam Foundation. In response to this problem, Nawaz has founded the Quilliam Foundation, a think tank that seeks to counter the message of the narrative. He has a new book out that reveals his provocative story. I want to read a little bit from the webpage here. The book is called Radical, My Journey from Islamic Extremism to Democratic Awakening. And this is on the website. It says, quote, born and raised in Essex, Majid Nawaz was recruited into politicized Islam as a teenager, abandoning his love for hip-hop music, graffiti, and girls. That's an interesting combination. He was recruited into Hizb-ut-Tahrir, the Liberation Party, where he played a leading and international role in the shaping and disseminating of an aggressive anti-West narrative. Continues, and here's a photo of him, while studying for his Arabic and law degree, he, Nawaz, traveled around the United Kingdom to Denmark and Pakistan, setting up new cells. Further, arriving in Egypt the day before 9/11, his views soon led to his arrest, imprisonment, mental torture, before being thrown into solitary confinement in a Cairo jail reserved for political prisoners. It says there, while mixing with everyone from the assassins of Egypt's president to liberal reformists, he underwent an intellectual transformation, and on his release after 4 years, he publicly renounced the Islamicist ideology that had defined his life. He says it cost him. This move would cost him his marriage, his family, and his friends, as well as his personal security. I've seen him debate. He takes on all comers. This guy's got a lot of courage. 6 years after his release, Majid now works all over the world to counter Islamicism and to promote democratic ideals through his organization, the Quilliam Foundation, which he co-founded with the former Islamist and best-selling author Ed Husain. Well, Majid Nawaz believes persuading Muslims that the narrative is false is the way to stop the war between the West and radical Islam. Let me note, if I might, kind of a sociological observation. Young men, maybe especially, are looking for meaning and purpose and significance in life. Young men are looking to belong. To talk about my own son, when my son saw the series Band of Brothers, I could tell that my son wanted to belong to a band of brothers. And there are lots of people who are taken in by this propaganda. They're told that they can become a soldier. And what better soldier than to be a soldier for God? And so Nawaz talks with these people. He debates them. I don't know what kind of security he has, but it's got to be pretty significant. Here's some quotes from the lectures and debates that I've watched. He says, is it not a crime when Muslims are killing Muslims? Why are we busy making excuses for the terrorists? Nawaz also says the jihadists are guilty of killing innocent civilians. Now, what I want to spend the rest of our time with, and then we can chat a little bit, is we've been talking about Islam, and we have been comparing and contrasting the religion with Christianity, noting that Christianity is able to explain things that Islam has a much harder time with. But I want to talk about the idea of ideology. I want to talk about the conflict that we see in the world that is by and large a religious conflict. And I want to present to you some of my thinking about this topic. I, of course, teach a comparative religions course at Biola University. It's in their MA program in Christian apologetics. The course examines the world's major religions, including Islam, in the light of the historic Christian worldview. Now, I tell my students that I believe only a small percentage of the world's Muslims have adopted the radical political religious philosophy that promotes and carries out acts of jihadist terror against innocent people. Now, what are the numbers? I don't think anybody knows. Daniel Pipes has said it may be 15%. The problem is, of course, with a worldwide population of 1.67 billion Muslims, approximately 23% of the world's population, even if only 5% have adopted a radical form of Islam, like that of Al-Qaeda, the numbers would be staggeringly ominous. I think we all understand that. Even if the numbers are small, it's a great threat. Ironically, many or most of the victims, and people in the West may not appreciate this point, many or most of the victims of radical Islamic terrorist acts are themselves Muslim. Think of the number of bombs that go off in Iraq on a daily basis. Look at Syria, and we can talk about Syria a little bit later if you'd like. Since the catastrophic events of September 11, 2001, I think the American government, via the military and law enforcement, has taken some effective measures to make America safer from the threat of terrorist attacks. However, to effectively confront and ultimately defeat radical Islam, Western democracies must also utilize a force that I think is more formidable than rockets and drones, although I affirm the use of those things, and that force is namely the force of ideas. An ideological conflict can be won only by presenting a superior philosophy of life, and I don't think we do it effectively enough. Let's now return to our discussion of Majid Nawaz. Nawaz, who appears in my mind to clearly be courageous and a moderate Muslim, go on the website, listen to his debates, check it out for yourself. He dialogues with and debates radical Muslims on college campuses, and he seeks to demonstrate what he thinks is their convoluted understanding of Islam. Now, I think the Western democracies should solidly support such efforts. To effect real change, these radical Muslims must come to view Islam differently. After all, this war on terrorism is at its core an ideological conflict, and thus also a spiritual one. Now, some people disagree with me. Some Christians with whom I've shared my views suggest that supporting and promoting moderate voices within the Islamic world will fail. Now, why do they say that? Because these Christians view Islam as inherently violent. To them, Islam possesses no truly moderate voices. Now, what do I say to that? Not all Americans think alike. Not all Christians think alike. Not all Reformed Christians think alike. I don't think any religion is a true monolith. I think it's possible to disassociate radical political ideologies from the traditional practice of Islam. If it can happen to those who murdered Sadat, it's possible for people to change. Now, granted, it isn't easy to change minds formed by fascist-like philosophies, but I think with such high stakes, we have to make the effort. Now, let's say we don't do this. Let's say we just say, well, Islam is just a violent religion. Nearly a quarter of the world's population is Muslim. We better hope that a majority of those are moderate Muslims who affirm peace and tolerance, or else the world is in for an even greater tribulation than the one described by some of the eschatological views held by Christians. Remember, one of the things we've noted in this series of lectures is that Christians and Muslims make up more than 50% of the world's population. If all Muslims are radical terrorists, we're in very, very serious trouble. The best scenario, obviously, from a historic Christian perspective, of course, would be for Muslims to come to know Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. That's the ideal. That's the Great Commission. That's why I work full-time in a apologetics ministry, because I believe that. I believe that the way we bring people to God is to preach the gospel, to defend it, evangelism, missions. The problem is that the great challenge is that many or most nations with an Islamic majority, they don't allow Christian proselytization. So we have a hard time clearly there was a problem with totalitarianism early in the 20th century, keeping Christianity out. Now we have a totalitarian Islamic element. So I encourage liberty-loving individuals to view the war against radical Islamic terrorism as similar to the Cold War, a long twilight struggle that will require military might, sound ideas, as well as concerted prayer. Frankly, I just don't think we've thought enough about what really changes people. I think what changes people are ideas. I remember when my father was reluctant to approve of me taking a philosophy degree until I told him that National Socialism was a philosophical movement. And he realized how powerful philosophies can be. And I hope liberty-loving Muslims will join in this effort, because most of the victims, again, of Islamic terrorist acts have been themselves Muslims. It's people in the Middle East. It's people in the Islamic world that end up getting killed by these radical Muslims. So since the narrative as an ideological falsehood is used to recruit people to a life of radical Islamic terrorism, I propose that it calls for five Christian apologetic considerations in response. What are they? First, the conspiratorial nature of the narrative demonstrates the absolute need to subject grand government conspiracy theories to sustained critical analysis. There are just way too many people who adopt conspiracy theories. It is terribly ironic that Americans... Now I might offend somebody. It's terribly ironic that Americans who believe that 9/11 was an inside job, they're called truthers, of course, and the estimates I've seen is about one-third of America agrees with that, that in a sense they are agreeing with some of the radical jihadists committed to fighting the United States. These radical jihadists believe that. But the 9/11 tangled web gets even more knotted. And here I want to present something to you that I think is, again, very powerful. There is a big debate going on in the Islamic jihadist community about who really pulled off 9/11. Was it the mastermind Osama bin Laden, or was it the mastermind George Bush? Of course, the interesting thing is a lot of people who adopt the 9/11 conspiracy theory, they talk about George Bush as if he is totally incompetent. But how could he be totally incompetent and knock the Twin Towers down? So there is this clash, and I want to introduce it to you. In September of 2011, Iran's then president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, addressed the General Assembly of the United Nations and stated that the United States government was responsible for the horrific events of 9/11. Moreover, Ahmadinejad claimed that America's sinister and clandestine act was motivated by an attempt to suppress Muslims and to prop up its ally, Israel. Now, again, the thinking here is either Israel is the head and America is the tail, or America's the head and Israel's the tail. But the idea is that these two groups, Americans and Israelis, are the ones who cooked up this idea of 9/11 for the very purpose then of allowing America to have justification to attack these Islamic countries. Now, that sounds pretty wild to me. Again, I'm told that on the Arab street, virtually no doubts about it whatsoever. Ahmadinejad's public accusations were not well received, as many UN diplomats, Americans as well as others, protested by walking out during the controversial speech. However, the strongest condemnation of Ahmadinejad's remarks came from the terrorist organization founded by Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda. They were angry. Why? In an article entitled Iran and the Conspiracy Theories in the latest issue of the English language magazine Inspire, an author under the byline of Abu Suhail, spoke for the terrorist network in sharply denouncing Ahmadinejad's comments on logical and evidentiary grounds. The author wrote this: "The Iranian government has professed on the tongue of its president, Ahmadinejad, that it does not believe that Al-Qaeda was behind 9/11, but rather the U.S. government. So we may ask the question, why would Iran ascribe to such a ridiculous belief that stands in the face of all logic and evidence?" The special issue of Inspire magazine celebrated the militant 9/11 attacks by calling them, quote, "the greatest special operation of all time." The article also pitted, now here's a key idea, the article pitted the two major branches in Islam against one another, Sunni versus Shiite, in proclaiming Al-Qaeda's elite status as Islamic jihadists. Again, here is the author. He says, quote, "Iran and the Shia in general do not want to give Al-Qaeda credit for the greatest and biggest operation ever committed against America, because this would expose their lip service jihad against the great Satan." Now, what's happening here? Essentially, Al-Qaeda is saying, these truthers are stealing our thunder. They're giving credit for what we did to the Americans. So who's really ticked off about this? Al-Qaeda is. Al-Qaeda, in essence, is outraged at Ahmadinejad for stealing their thunder and undermining their legacy as the world's most notorious terrorists. So what you have is essentially Al-Qaeda coming along and saying, you know what, this is really a battle among the major denominations within Islam. I wrote an article about this. It's on the Reasons to Believe site. It's entitled "Islamic Jihadists Clash Over 9/11 Conspiracy Theory." If you've never been on the Reasons site, you just click under New Reasons to Believe magazine and my article will pop up. So what are we to think here? Well, in essence, the two radical Islamic groups, which I would say is the Iranian government on one hand and Al-Qaeda on the other, they can't agree about who is truly responsible for 9/11. So here's my question. Could it be that such grand conspiracy theories need to be challenged? If a third of Americans believe George Bush knocked the Twin Towers down, what they need, I think, to be told is that they're agreeing with America's great enemy, that America is the great Satan. Well, since today marks the 50th anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination, it seems especially important to challenge conspiratorial thinking. Now, some of you are probably not going to agree with me, but I think Lee Harvey Oswald killed Kennedy all by himself. And I think Jack Ruby was almost as big a kook as Oswald was, and he did it all by himself. Now, what happens when people promote conspiracy theories? Well, we damage the reputation of various people. The Warren Commission were made up of very fine Americans. And yet, if you watch a movie like JFK under Oliver Stone, basically, when I watched that movie, I came to the conclusion that everybody but Oswald killed Kennedy. FBI, CIA, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, virtually everybody did it. The only one who was not there was Oswald. What does that say about Gerry Ford, who was on the Warren Commission, who was one of our presidents? What does that say about Earl Warren, who was the Chief Justice for the United States, Supreme Court? You know, people throw around ideas, but who gets hurt by them? I would suggest that the conspiracies have led people to challenge the government, which isn't always a bad thing, but I think it's led people to think that there are deep conspiracy theories. Now, lest I... lest I have not convinced you that conspiracy theories can be really problematic, according to Winston Churchill, who I would have been tempted to give man of the century to, rather than to Albert Einstein, I think I would have given it to Churchill. According to Winston Churchill, a man named Albert Speer was the most important Nazi because his competence in managing the German war machine as Minister of Armaments and Munitions lengthened the war by 2 years. Churchill said, Albert Speer took the German army that was about to collapse, and because he was so efficient at using slave labor, he met all of Hitler's goals, and the war lasted 2 more years than it should have. But when were most of the people killed in World War II? The last 2 years. Yet, as the powerful quote below reveals, Speer joined the Nazi Party without applying critical thinking, a lesson for the ages. 1 Thessalonians 5:21, what does that verse say? Test all things and hold on to the good. Now, the context of the passage is prophecy, but I think the implication can be applied more broadly. People ought to test. Now here's Albert Speer. Let me give you a little bit of background about him. Speer was Hitler's architect. I think Hitler liked Speer because Hitler wanted to be an architect. But Speer was really a genius. He was a remarkable individual. And at Nuremberg, he was put on trial, and he received a 20-year prison sentence. Probably he should have been put to death. But the reason he wasn't is because he was the one key Nazi who said, you know what, the Allies are right. We basically murdered millions of people. And because that set up the Nuremberg trials well, I think he was given somewhat of a pass by the Americans and the British. The Russians wanted all of them hung. They didn't even want any trial of any of them. Well, Speer spent 20 years in prison, and he wrote a book called Inside the Third Reich that became a bestseller. When he got out of prison, he was interviewed by Playboy magazine. He became a celebrity, a brilliant man. And this is what he says in his book, Inside the Third Reich. Speer says, my decision to enter Hitler's party was no less frivolous. Why, for example, was I willing to abide by the almost hypnotic impression Hitler's speech had made upon me? Why did I not undertake a thorough, systematic investigation of, say, the value or worthlessness of the ideologies of all the parties? Why did I not read the various party programs, or at least Hitler's Mein Kampf and Rosenberg's Myth of the 20th Century? Rosenberg was kind of the token Nazi philosopher. As an intellectual, I might have been expected to collect documentation with the same thoroughness and to examine various points of view with the same lack of bias that I had learned to apply to my preliminary architectural studies. As a result, I remained uncritical. Now, let me bring you back again to why did the Germans want to murder the Jews? Because they owned the money markets, because they were the intelligentsia behind communism. Ladies and gentlemen, the ideas that led to the systematic extermination of more than 6 million Jews were unfounded conspiracy theories. Unfounded conspiracy theories. Now the question, of course, is whether Hitler believed it, was he a true believer, or did he invent it in order to gain power? And obviously, there was a lot of anti-Semitism in Europe long before Hitler came along. But the question is, Hitler was essentially able to do this, and Albert Speer is a very candid individual. Lots of people have died based upon unfounded conspiracy theories. So I would propose that in light of Speer's quote about the need to be critical, that I would respectfully challenge anyone, and particularly Christians, who believe that the 9/11 conspiracy, to read and contemplate a paper that I wrote. Again, you can get it on the Reasons to Believe website. It's entitled Thinking Through Big Government Conspiracy Theories. Thinking Through Big Government Conspiracy Theories. Additionally, for people who have questions about the growing 9/11 conspiracy perspective, and I know there are people who have legitimate questions. Popular Mechanics, I think, did a superb job. They brought some of the best engineers in the world. They brought in some of the best scientists. They asked them, how did these buildings come down? What happened? They just did an outstanding job. It's very objective. I think they answer all of the questions that people normally have about this. Now, it's deeply troubling to note that the jihadist enemies of America, motivated in large part by what I would consider to be, candidly, a bogus conspiracy theory, are striking against innocent civilians. I don't take the 9/11 conspiracy theory seriously. But on the Arab street, they don't doubt it. Careful attention should be paid to asking logical questions when thinking about alleged plots. So here are my five logical questions to consider when thinking about conspiracy claims. Number one, coherence. The question is this: does the theory hold together foundationally? Well-conceived theories are logically sound and internally consistent. Viable explanatory theories avoid being self-stultifying or self-defeating in nature. That means contradictory by both affirming and denying essential elements of the same theory. When the coherence question is properly applied, grand conspiracy theories often begin to unravel. That's the fundamental question that I think you should ask of anything you believe. Does it hold together? Is it coherent? Does it pass the test of logic? If it does, then you can ask some other questions. Lots of people adopt conspiracy theories without asking a fundamental question like this. Number two, data. Does the theory comport with the facts? Were the Jews really the intelligentsia behind the Soviet Union? Were they manipulating the money markets? Did they really have that power? Good theories are closely connected to the facts. They not only correspond to known facts, but also make sense by tying them together in a coherent fashion. Conspiracy theories can at times be short on facts or fail to conform to them. We constantly see this. A good theory is not only going to make sense of the facts. The facts are going to be something that they're connected, but it'll be able to explain the facts. Three, knowledge. Does the theory avoid unwarranted presumption? There's a huge difference between presuming to know something and, in fact, knowing something. Genuine knowledge includes proper justification for our beliefs. Solid theories are based on that which can be proved or verified. Too often, conspiracy theories are heavily laden with unjustified presumption. Number four, competition. How well does the theory withstand counter-evidence and viable challenges? Some of you who hear me teach regularly, you will often hear me say, what's the best argument on the other side? I think that that's a very important question. If you take a position, what's the best argument on the other side? Competition, how well does a theory withstand counter-evidence and viable challenges? Feasible theories are flexible enough to accommodate possible counter-evidence. The most potent explanatory theories carefully consider the best critiques from alternative perspectives and can answer the challenges. Critical thinking, however, demands that a person fairly consider viable alternatives. But again, too many people who believe in big government conspiracy theories have not done so. I mean, why did the Warren Commission conclude that Oswald killed Kennedy? Well, some people will immediately say, well, they were just covering up. Well, you can't begin with the assumption. You got to have some evidence that would lead you to conclude that. Number five, verification. Is the theory open to falsification? I think that's an excellent question. Is it open to falsification? If so, how? Viable explanatory theories make claims that can be tested and proven true or false, verified or falsified. Non-falsifiable claims that cannot be investigated, evaluated, and critiqued carry little rational weight. Unfortunately, some who hold to conspiracy theories have never given careful thought as to how their belief might be legitimately falsified. I mean, what if somebody would have gone up to Hitler and said, and what would falsify your theory about the Jews? What if somebody would go up to Oliver Stone and say, and Mr. Stone, what would falsify your theory? When I watched JFK, I couldn't figure out if anything would falsify. In fact, he did an interview just the other day, and they asked him, could you come to the conclusion that maybe Oswald was an anomaly and that sometimes individuals change history? And the first word out of his mouth was, governments lie. That's what they do. Well, they may, but how do you test it? How do you test it? Here is what I think are the four big government conspiracy theories. The JFK assassination is the granddaddy of all conspiracy theories. If we're still here in 50 more years, people will still be talking about it. UFO conspiracy, we were talking a little bit prior to the lecture. People are always looking for some explanation. If you reject traditional religion, if you reject secularism, then you have to adopt some explanation. UFOs, very popular. 9/11, a third of Americans believe it. Secret society conspiracy theories, they go all the way back to the founding fathers. These ideas have been around for a long time. Again, I invite you to take a look at the Reasons to Believe website, reasons.org. I have an article entitled Thinking Through Big Government Conspiracy Theories. Now, do I think all conspiracy theories are false? I do not. I think that there are conspiracy theories. Abraham Lincoln was killed by a small conspiracy. I do believe that government needs to be legitimately challenged. I would suggest, however, I think a lot of the unrest and upheaval that America experienced in the 60s and forward was unfortunately, I think, influenced by conspiracy theories that were not adequately tested. And could I propose, that's why I think we have to look very carefully at the resurrection. The issue, though, is the closer you look at the resurrection, I think the more you become convinced that it's true. And everything has been thrown at the resurrection for 2,000 years, and it still stands. Let me make a second point. Christians must also value and practice sound principles of logic and critical thinking. Believers are not immune to unhealthy ideological thinking and bogus conspiracy theories. In fact, I think Christians seem especially susceptible to belief in big government conspiracy theories. Now, you say, why? Well, this vulnerability rises first because Christians believe there is a hidden and malevolent demonic force behind the world events. Thus, they are sometimes excessively suspicious of stealth forces at work in the world. That's the first reason. This intuition, of course, may serve as sound theological discernment, but it must be rigorously tested in particular cases. Thinking there is a demon under every bush can be as faulty as ignoring the demonic realm completely. That's my C.S. Lewis example. A good way of testing one's suspicions about such matters is to appeal to Scripture and to sound reason, such as the five questions discussed above. Also, many believers hold eschatological end-time views that involve a strong belief in a one-world government. While this view may be a legitimate understanding, maybe, of what Scripture reveals concerning future things, it is one interpretation among several and therefore should be examined carefully. I'm proposing that when Christians think about eschatology, well, there's the demonic hand, and don't we know that there's going to be this one world government, so there is a deep suspicion. And I think sometimes that suspicion can lead people into ideas that are not sound. Further, it is far too easy to speculate when it comes to the difficult task of interpreting passages in the Bible that appear to describe future events. George Eldon Ladd, the great New Testament scholar that taught at Fuller Seminary, Professor Ladd says, look, apocalyptic literature, very difficult to interpret. I don't hear that very often. I don't hear pastors and teachers say, you know, the book of Daniel, the book of Revelation, we really got to wrestle with them. They're apocalyptic literature. No, they talk about them as if they're yesterday's newspapers. So can Christians be caught up into bad exegesis? Can they be caught up into conspiracy theories? Yeah. Any of us can. If Albert Speer can, I think we can. As part of the Imago Dei, human beings possess intellectual faculties necessary to be what theologian John Calvin called hunters and gatherers of truth. What a great line from Calvin. He said, to be made in the image of God means that we're hunters and gatherers of a particular thing. We have been made to be able to hunt and gather the truth. Scripture implores believers to be wise and discerning when it comes to truth claims. Again, 1 Thessalonians 5:21. Third, the 60 Minutes broadcast also illustrates the absolutely critical, even life or death role of big picture thinking, ideology, worldview for individuals, nations, and civilizations. Christians who want to engage effectively in evangelism, missions, and apologetics must learn to think in terms of worldview. Everybody has a worldview. Everybody makes sense of reality. How does the Christian worldview differ with other worldviews? And how do people change in their worldview? Knowing the basic categories of worldview thinking and how to test worldviews, I think, is critical. That's why I wrote the book, A World of Difference. And I have 9 tests. I say, here's what a worldview is. Here's how to test it. Here's how to critique it. And here's why I think the Christian worldview is superior to all these other worldviews. Fourth, believers would do well to study the basic tenets of Islam and how those beliefs differ with the essential teaching of historic Christianity. Islam is a major force today with approximately 1.67 billion adherents worldwide. Moreover, Islam constitutes not just a religion, but in their minds, also a civilization and a distinct world and life view. And then finally, why does a Calvinist always have 5 points? Fifth, Christian thinkers should take it upon themselves to explain and defend the essential features of Western civilization. Now, I think one of the difficulties that we have is that we live in a time that I think is influenced by postmodern ways of thinking. And part of that is don't judge other people or don't judge other belief systems. Well, the truth of the matter is, of course, from a Christian point of view, is that we're all sinners. But I don't think that rules out the idea that some beliefs are better than other beliefs. Some beliefs are true and others are false. Some beliefs are partly true. I think that my children's generation, the so-called millennial generation, I think they're going to have to defend democracy. I think they're going to have to go back and say, democracy is not perfect, but we've never had to build a wall to keep our people in, to quote John F. Kennedy. I think we're going to have to go back and show the world why democracy is superior to other forms of government. I think we're going to have to talk about things that we deeply believe that are in the Constitution. Freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly. The West is not better than the East, but there are ideas that are better than other ideas. They're truer. They work. And I think we'll also have to defend capitalism. Capitalism is obviously not a perfect economic system, but it does allow for the possibility of a lot of boats being raised. And therefore, I think that a lot of people who live in the West are going to have to go back and make a defense. And if I can return to my earlier point, ultimately a false narrative needs to be replaced by a true narrative, one that results in not only a temporary cessation of hostilities, but also an everlasting peace. That is, I really do believe that ideas rule the world. If you study the life of Adolf Hitler, this guy was a bum. He was living on the street. He was a nobody. And he came within this much of controlling the world. Ideas really matter. And while I will grant that I think Presidents Bush and even President Obama have made some good decisions in the use of military, certainly good decisions about law enforcement in protecting our great country, I don't think you can win the war against radical Islam with only weapons. I think you have to use the greater weapon, and the greater weapon is good ideas. And more than that, it's the gospel. Because Christianity can offer things that Islam cannot. Christianity can offer things that no other ideology, no other worldview, no other religion can offer. And so you can listen to these five lectures on the church website. Again, entitled A Christian Response to Islam, What Does Historic Christianity Offer the World That Islam Cannot? And that's christreform.org. And you just click under Professor Kenneth Sample's lectures. And I hope that this will also become a series that will be available through Reasons to Believe. Let me mention some good books. I see no clock in the back. A broken clock is right twice a day, Dan. Let me mention some books for you, and then we'll have some time of question and answer here. I, of course, have two books that I write about the Christian worldview, and I compare other worldview perspectives. There are some very good books written by Christian scholars about both the world's religion and Islam. I especially like Neighboring Faiths by Wynn Corjan. He's very fair, very careful, good theologian. I like the Geisler Salib book as well, Answering Islam. There's a new book by James White, What Every Christian Needs to Know About the Quran. Very helpful book, very insightful about the Quran, about how it came to be, about how Muslims view it. James White's a very good debater, good theologian. And here are a couple books that I would recommend reading. I think you need to read people who actually believe that Islam is true. This book, Islam, Religion, History, and Civilization by Syed Hossein Nassar. He is a leading authority on Islam. He now lives in the United States. He has condemned 9/11. He condemned Osama bin Laden. Very readable book. It'll help you understand basic ideas. John Esposito is a Catholic scholar at Georgetown, considered an American specialist on Islam, very, very helpful in terms of understanding the religion of Islam. Well, let me stop there, and I need to keep my eye on the clock because I can't go past 9 o'clock or I cause problems for the tape. But we do have some time to maybe field some questions or to talk about some of the hopefully provocative ideas I've raised. Who has a question or a comment that you'd like to make? Yeah, Phil. Well, it's a good question. I think when you look broadly, I have to be careful now, I have to be very fair to all the millennial views. But Phil, you're very familiar that a form of premillennialism adopts the idea that the Antichrist will at some stage take control over what is often interpreted as being a one-world government. Now, that is far from certain from the standpoint that there have been many Christian scholars who've interpreted things very differently. Obviously, a post-millennial perspective sees things largely moving in a positive direction rather than a negative direction. It's also true, though, that I think the all-millennial view sees things moving toward great persecution for the church near the time of the end. And the all-millennial view would see a literal antichrist along with forms of premillennialism. But I think your question is a good question, and that is, should we view any strong government as being potentially harmful? Now, don't get me wrong. I think people want to retain power. I think that's a natural tendency that sinful people have. They want to keep the power they have. They want to shift the blame onto other people. I don't have a problem with that. I, however, do think that lots of people looked at the Kennedy assassination and with their radical political philosophies tried to entertain the idea that American government was no better than other governments of the world. That the American government's no better than the government of the Soviet Union. Now, believe me, I don't think America does everything right, but I think that sometimes these beliefs about government are irrational, and I think some people take their basic eschatological principles, and I think that fans the flame, that they think someday the Antichrist is going to have a one-world government, so any movement in that direction they see as a negative. I think we simply have to think through all of those things. Government can do good things. I think what's clearly evident is the United States government's military has been awfully good for a very, very long time. Now, whether they can do other things well is room for debate. How about another question or a comment? Yeah, Peggy. Yeah, that's a good question. Let me as a means of trying to tackle your question, Peggy. Again, I was watching 60 Minutes, and my view is that sometimes 60 Minutes is really, really good, and then sometimes it's not very good at all. But I've seen some really good programs on there. Not too long ago, they had a fellow who was second in command for the CIA. He had just retired a couple weeks before Benghazi. So this guy's been there for 30 years, and he began talking about Syria, and he was describing what was happening in Syria, I thought, in very interesting terms. Now, let's see if I can remember them all. He says there are four wars going on in Syria. He says the first war is that the basic average everyday person in Syria is rebelling against their perceived view that Assad is a wicked dictator. So that's one war. A second war is that Al-Qaeda is there, and they see Assad as a secular leader. So they're fighting against what they think is a secular Islamic government when they want a religious Islamic government. A third war, according to this scholar from the CIA, he says there is a heavy war going on between Shiite and Sunni for control of who's going to have the top denomination or theological school of thought. And then there is a fourth war where Saudi Arabia and Iran have a proxy war for which Islamic government is going to have final say in the Middle East. Now, back to your original question. I think that there are people who have been thinking about these ideas for a very long time. And obviously, to be in the American government, and particularly to be in the military, you swear an oath to defend America and to protect America. And there are a lot of very bright people who have been looking at these issues of terrorism. Could I ask this? Are there Christians who think this way? I mean, there are obviously people in the CIA and the FBI and the military, and there are undoubtedly people in the House of Representatives and the Senate who think about what is America's interest in the world, how do we protect our citizens, how do we advance our power in the world. Are there Christians who are seriously thinking about how ideas are going to impact radical Islam? I hope so, but I think the idea that somehow we can stop radical Islam with purely military force. Now, don't get me wrong, I believe that military force can be a power for good. Frankly, I think the guys that landed on Normandy, they saved the world. Just think for a moment. What if Hitler would have won that war? What if Imperial Japan had won the war? What would the world look like? I think there'd just be one big prison camp. How many people died in World War II? Well, when I was a kid studying the war, it was 50 million. Now I'm on Wikipedia, it says 78 million. Maybe because we know more about what happened in China and the Soviet Union. Your question, Peggy, is a really good one. I suspect that there are people in the military who very much do think about worldview ideas, and they do think about how much of Al-Qaeda is an ideology and how much of it is religious. I would simply propose, I think Christians need to think more about those ways of thinking. And yeah, I mean, if we really do believe that the gospel is the power to save, I think we ought to give a lot more attention to that kind of thing. And I would invite you, Peggy, to take a look at this 60 Minutes episode. I mean, it was very revealing. I mean, I had no idea there were four wars going on there. And I wonder if Christians shouldn't be thinking that way. Yeah, back here, question. It's a great question. Let me see if I can summarize your question for purposes of our tape. Obviously, the Muslims have very deep political views about what's happening in the world, geopolitics. And there is a great deal of anger and hostility toward Israel. And if I could complicate matters even more, there is the basic idea among Muslims that if a particular land was ever owned or occupied by Muslims, it can never be given up. It has to go back. If you have to fight 1,000 years, then you fight 1,000 years. Now, so there is a lot of hostility about Israel. In fact, there are some Muslims, one Islamic fellow said about me. He said, Ken Samples calls for moderate Muslims to condemn the terrorist acts of radical Muslims. And I do. He says, well, then why doesn't Ken Samples call on Israel to stop the terrorism that they're engaging in? Well, again, these political issues run very deep. Now, I've just written a book on eschatology. I don't buy the idea that Israel becoming a nation is like a clock ticking and is going to lead to all these events. I could be wrong, but I don't hold that view. Now, having said that, I do think it's extraordinary that Israel became a nation. And I'm even willing to grant, and of course this is a no-brainer, I believe God's sovereignty is involved in all of this. I do think this, though, I think it's very difficult for people to set aside their political viewpoints. For a lot of people who are not religious, I think politics is the replacement religion. If you don't believe in God, you're probably going to come up with some ideology, some political system, some worldview that's going to give your life and humanity meaning. So I think it's very difficult to change the way people think politically. I would say a couple things. I don't think we should allow politics to keep us from talking with Muslims about Jesus Christ. Whatever an Arab on the Arab street thinks about Israel and the Palestinians, what's more important than his political views is whether Jesus is the Savior of the world, whether Jesus is the Messiah. So I would talk with a Muslim and set aside politics if I could. The problem, though, is that these are deeply entrenched ideas. And my view is that I think if the Palestinians had cooperated with Israel, I think they would have had all the things they already wanted. I think they made a fundamental mistake of not working with Israel to try to work it together. And I think you have these terrorist organizations that basically control much of the Palestinian point of view. Hezbollah, I think these are radical groups. So you got a big problem on your hands. You have deep differences of religion and deep differences of political ways of thinking. But I think we do have to challenge people when they begin to adopt an ideology that's based upon fiction. And again, you know, whatever Hitler had against the Jews, whatever anti-Semitism existed in Europe, back it up. Show that that's the case. And they couldn't. And I mean, if you can have the death of 70 million people that at least in part was started based upon unjustified conspiracy theories, then I think people do need to be challenged. Now, don't get me wrong. I think that there is a time when you can question things. I mean, I don't think it's wrong at all. Today's the 50th anniversary of JFK's assassination. I don't think it's illegitimate to say, could Oswald do the shooting? I mean, did he have enough time? Was the Mannlicher Carcano reliable? Did he have the qualifications to do the shooting? That seems like a reasonable question to me. Why did Jack Ruby kill Lee Harvey Oswald? That seems like a reasonable question to me. But the problem is when there's no way to falsify a view. I think one of the powerful things about science as an enterprise, as a truth-seeking enterprise, is it they develop a hypothesis and then they try to shoot it down. And if they can't shoot it down, then you know it's got something going for it. My problem with these conspiracy theories that are connected to political theories is that people never, I think, ask the question, or seldom ask the question, what if I'm wrong? What if I'm wrong? And I ask that question about Christianity. What if I'm wrong? When I was sick in the hospital 10 years ago, I went through a period of doubt. And my brain wasn't working as well as it usually is. And I asked myself, could I be wrong? Could I possibly be mistaken? And I, to the best that I could in the hospital when I was alone at night, I thought through the options and I thought, I think Christianity makes the best sense and I'm going to trust the Lord. I don't think there's anything wrong with raising questions about your basic beliefs. And I think if the resurrection is true, it's going to stand up, and I think it will. So you've asked a really, really good question. How do we work with people who have differing political and religious views? It's not easy. Not easy. Yeah, it's got to be part of the testing process. But let's, for the purposes of the tape, let me summarize. Your contention is that we live in a world where a lot of people believe a lot of things, and quite a few of those things are not based upon logic, and that human beings seemingly are not committed to applying these principles, and that there may be there's other factors that go into a person believing. Yeah, I agree with you. I grant your premise, but I think we're taught in Scripture to test things. And I would say that it's true that reason in and of itself will not always carry the day. But I would argue, if I can quote Aristotle, logos, ethos, pathos, I don't think, even though Aristotle's basically wrote the book on persuasion, I think Jesus was following that book. I think Jesus used reason. I think he appealed to his moral credibility. And I think he used storytelling as a way of pulling people in, a kind of a shared vision of reality. So my response to you would be, I agree. But just because people abuse something or don't properly use something, that doesn't mean that we ought to give up on it. I'm proposing that the way you evaluate ideological theories is you asked really good questions. You put them to the test. Now, obviously, I don't think a person can come to faith purely based upon rationality. I mean, I'm an Augustinian after all. But where I would differ, though, is I think the Holy Spirit uses arguments and reasons and rationality. So I agree, reason may not always carry the day. So a view that's reasonable, that doesn't make it true, but if it's unreasonable, I think it's false. So I think that this is a very powerful way of teaching people, and it may be that a lot of people are not trained, they're not taught to ask these kind of fundamental questions. And I don't think those questions have to be purely logical. I think we could also ask, is this good? Does it contribute toward the good? There are a series of questions that we can ask. So I grant your premise, lots of people are not logical. And how do you know that the enculturation or this influence is actually valid and true as opposed to some manipulative means?
Right. Well, that's the issue.
You're not suggesting we throw out reason and logic. You're saying that they have limits. But would you grant, though, that the way of falsifying is the way of logic and reason and facts and evidence? That's all I'm saying. And what would your apologetic approach be? What would characterize your apology? I've told you mine. Mine would be essentially that the true worldview will explain the meaningful realities of life in a superior way to alternatives. What would yours be? But saying things doesn't make it true. I present arguments. Just saying, for example, saying that Allah is loving when he has no one to love in eternity, I think raises legitimate questions about how is Allah loving. Whereas I think the Trinity, whether it's true or not is another question, but if the Trinity is true, this community of personhood, I think, carries a great deal of explanatory power. So the question is, how do you know which one is superior? Well, which one does seem to explain data? Which one does seem to explain the realities of life? I think there are a lot of meaningful realities, the cosmos, life itself, ethics, abstractions, religion, and I think we should push those tests. See, I think the problem with the world is we haven't used enough reason and rationality. I think reason and rationality are the good gifts of the Lord. And I don't know any other means of adjudicating whether something is true other than using the conceptual faculties, the cognitive faculties and the sensory organs that we have, other than maybe appealing to some sense of intuition. I mean, that's the way we do it in the courts.